You're listening to Becoming Wildly Resilient, brought to you by University of Kentucky Human Resources Health and Wellness. Join us as we explore tools, practices, meditations, and conversations with the members of the UK community. Together, we will discover how we can thrive at work, home, and beyond. Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of Becoming Wildly Resilient Conversations. My name is Sebastian Kalmes. I'm a wellness specialist with UKHR Health and Wellness and your host for today's episode. We're discussing mindful self-compassion today, and I feel like this is a really important topic for anybody because we go through our lives with this desire to achieve, whether from ourselves or from society or family. And as humans, sometimes we don't quite hit the mark. Mm-hmm. And then how we talk to ourselves or how we treat ourselves could have an impact on our well-being. To talk with me about mindful self-compassion today, I have Eric Wilkinson. Eric, thanks for being on the show with me.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Could you just tell me a little bit about your role at UK right now?
I'm one of the four full-time therapists in UK Health and Wellness. I've been in this position for a little over 4 years. I've been a licensed clinical social worker and a therapist. It's coming up on about 20 years. The position is such that all UK faculty and staff, as well as their spouses and dependents, are entitled to 5 free counseling sessions every year. And we provide those counseling sessions. The sessions are not part of anyone's medical record. They're not part of any kind of employment record. Because we are not billing insurance, we don't provide formal diagnoses, although we're all licensed therapists and have worked in settings in the past where we have worked within a diagnostic framework. These counseling sessions can be used for anything. There's the classic reasons that people come in, such as grief, loss, anxiety, or depression. But we also have people that are just trying to figure out maybe what they want to do in their career, or maybe they're having some interpersonal issues, or they're just wanting to learn some new skills. So we provide these counseling services. And then in addition to that, we also provide presentations and workshops based on emotional, psychological issues of interest to the campus community.
Thank you for being here and supporting this UK community. You also do presentations. Mm-hmm. And one of those presentations I've experienced firsthand, and that's the mindful self-compassion mm-hmm. presentation. How did that presentation become part of your scope?
In my years of working with folks, one of the things that has always stood out is that a large part of the suffering people experience is based on self-criticism, being really hard on themselves, a lot of self-judgment. You mentioned we do internalize unrealistic expectations, whether it's standards of beauty, standards of achievement, what our life is supposed to look like. Most of the time when people ask themselves, how am I doing in my life? The immediate response is not good enough, or I could be doing better. One of the things I realized is helping folks to develop a little bit more kindness towards themselves, a little bit more understanding. It can be incredibly liberating. This led me to get into the literature around self-compassion, which is an evidence-based umbrella term for evidence-based interventions. I started reading Tara Brach's works. She has 2 real classic books, Radical Acceptance and Radical Compassion. This led me to 2 other psychologists, Kristin Neff and Chris Germer. Kristin Neff is actually the first psychologist to define self-compassion in academic literature. And in 2019, I did a training with Kristin Neff, Chris Germer, at the Center of Self-Compassion, and was trained in mindful self-compassion specifically. Following that training, I partnered with Jackie Carroll, who is a health coach in health and wellness, and we developed a series of self-compassion workshops. Originally, it was 4 workshops. We've expanded it to now 8 workshops. Then there started to be a lot of requests once we started engaging in these workshops for one-off presentations, and that's how the presentation format came about.
You mentioned Tara Brach's work, Radical Self-Acceptance and Radical Self-Compassion.
Radical Acceptance was her first book, and then more recently, Radical Compassion.
What makes that radical? Is that more of a buzzword, or is there something that intrinsically changes us when we follow her system?
Many of us don't struggle a lot when it comes to engaging with pleasant experiences, positive emotions. We may be distracted in our lives or overworking, and that can get in the way of connecting to positive experiences and positive emotions. But generally speaking, we're not resistant to them. We seek them out. However, we often try to avoid, it's natural to avoid pain. So we try to avoid painful experiences. We try not to think about parts of ourselves that we are unhappy with or that we feel dissatisfied. We try to block out feelings of inadequacy or feelings of shame. These are universal human experiences. And so the practice is radical in the sense of embracing all our experience, trying to lean into both the painful and the pleasurable experiences, trying to build a relationship with all parts of ourself, not exiling the parts of ourselves that we don't like.
Building relationships with all the parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can see parts of myself that I don't want to look at.
Right.
It's hard to accept that's me too.
Yes. I think it's pretty universal. There may be some cultural differences depending on where you grow up in the world, but generally we all want to avoid painful experiences. And when there are aspects of our lives that, again, that we feel either feelings of shame about or we feel hurt around, we tend to want to block those out or dissociate from those experiences or parts of ourselves.
In understanding mindful self-compassion, would it be helpful to understand the definition of compassion?
One definition that I often cite when I do presentations is this 2010 definition by Gertz, Keltner, and Simon. The definition of compassion is that compassion is the feeling that arises when witnessing another's suffering, and that motivates a subsequent desire to help. That's a working definition for compassion. We witness suffering and we feel this impulse to want to help. Sometimes people conflate compassion with empathy. Those words often are thrown around together. Compassion starts with empathy. It requires us to connect to feelings of pain or suffering that we're witnessing either in another person or in ourselves. But after that initial step of empathy, we then move to this wanting to help or wanting to provide care. And that moves us into a different region of our brain that's associated with affiliation and connection and love. Whereas empathy, we can experience empathetic joy, we can experience empathetic distress. Empathy is really just connecting with the feelings that we're witnessing in another person and ourselves. Compassion tends to be more positive emotion because it is in the part of our brain associated with love and affiliation.
Mm. If I'm understanding, compassion is like empathy in action?
Yes, starting from a place of empathy and then moving to a place of wanting to express kindness or provide help.
Mm.
Kristen Neff, I mentioned she was the first one to define self-compassion. In 2003, she defined self-compassion as the clear seeing of our own suffering, a caring response to our suffering that includes the desire to help, and recognition that suffering is part of the shared human condition.
And I remember in one of your presentations, I believe you had asked us, how simple is it to go to help somebody?
Mm-hmm.
And then you asked, how simple is it to go and help yourself? That's and the answers are vastly different, where a lot of the time it's a lot harder and not as simple to just help ourselves. Why is that?
One of the exercises that you're referring to that we do from the Mindful Self-Compassion curriculum is an exercise titled How We Treat a Friend. Human beings are very much a social species. We have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to care about fellow human beings. We are aware that our livelihood, our well-being, our very lives are dependent on other human beings. When we see other people suffering, it's a natural response to want to step in and help. With ourselves, this is where there does tend to be a cultural divide. If we think about the history of the concept of self-compassion, Chris Germer and Kristen Neff, they trace it back to a conversation at a mindfulness conference in the late 80s where people were asking the Dalai Lama different questions. And they were pointing out this very observation that it's often easy to be kind to people we see who are suffering, but many of us, our response to ourselves might be, get over it. It's not a big deal. What's wrong with you? Suck it up. And the Dalai Lama seemed surprised by this, didn't really understand it, because from the Dalai Lama's perspective, we are living beings too. Why would we extend kindness to other living beings but not to ourselves? This recognition that within particularly Western culture, that being kind to oneself, identifying our needs and prioritizing our needs, that this is often seen as a negative attribute, as maybe as a form of selfishness, or that it's much more noble to care for others than to care for ourselves. We know that many people live lives where they say, I put everyone's needs ahead of my own. And people will say that with both a recognition that this creates suffering, but also a sense that they're doing the right thing. It was in the course of this realization that when we deny our own needs and we don't care for ourselves and we only prioritize others, ultimately it's not sustainable and it creates a lot of pain and a lot of unnecessary suffering.
Would you say that if somebody desires to help others as best they can, it would be wise to first help yourself?
There doesn't even really need to be a hierarchy. One of the mantras that I like is my needs are not more important than other people's needs, but they're as important. Mm-hmm. When you see living beings, whether it's ourselves or others, experiencing pain or suffering, trying to respond with kindness, trying to help.
Mm-hmm. My needs are not less or more mm-hmm. important, but as important mm-hmm. as others. Mm-hmm. Would you say that could make it confusing on what actions to take or what decisions to make?
I think you're really getting at the importance of wisdom, of knowing when and how to act. If we think about, again, self-compassion is not selfishness. We think about what selfishness is. It's acting in the pursuit of our own interests while ignoring the needs or concerns of others, or even acting in a way that we meet our own needs, but it's to the detriment of others. This broadening your perspective to see yourself as part of a community, part of a larger whole. So you're simultaneously identifying what do I need while also trying to understand the needs of others. And then knowing when to intervene in which way. If we don't meet our basic needs, if we don't get sleep, if we don't give ourselves proper nutrition and exercise, ultimately we're not going to be available to help others. Their well-being is dependent on our well-being, and our well-being is dependent on their well-being.
That brought to mind the mindfulness aspect mm-hmm. of mindful self-compassion. That sounds like it's something we practice and we cultivate to recognize what is a selfish action and what is actually just taking care of yourself.
Yes. When people become more self-compassionate, they're checking in with themselves, their physical needs throughout the day, their emotional needs. They're trying to provide for their needs throughout the day, which makes them available to be caring towards others. When people are experiencing a lot of pain, there's a tendency to turn inward, to withdraw, to isolate, to become emotionally reactive. Those tendencies don't make us a very available, fun person to be around. Mm-hmm. When you think about mindfulness, it's both this kind of awareness and also this idea of radical acceptance, accepting things as they are. It doesn't mean that we approve of how things are, but that we are tuning into reality, that we're acknowledging both the good and bad, the painful and the pleasurable. There may be times when there are competing needs. And I think lots of people struggle with that, their professional needs, their family needs, the needs their children have and their friends may have. It's this idea of let me care for myself, let me see what I need so that I'm then available to care for others. It also requires awareness of what our core values are. Many times people will go years or entire lifetime without thinking about their core values. Our values should provide direction about where we put our energy and what we prioritize.
One of my core values is taking responsibility for my thoughts, actions, words, intentions. If I'm feeling an emotion, like anger, I try really hard not to take that out on anybody. Could you tell me a little bit about a naming tool with naming emotions?
Mm-hmm. You know, mindfulness, it's this awareness and acceptance for what is. It also creates some spaciousness where we don't over-identify with our thoughts or feelings. If we experience anger and we are absolutely one with the anger, we're ignoring our value systems, we're ignoring the context of whatever situation has caused us anger, we're not paying attention, usually are often under anger, our feelings of hurt. Maybe we're locked into the anger, but we're not identifying what's the hurt underneath. We can act in a way where we're just completely one with the anger, and that can be destructive. We can act in a way where we lash out because we're feeling pain. We inflict pain on others. One of the things I like specifically about Kristen Neff's work is she talks openly about her own struggles with anger, differentiates between constructive anger and destructive anger. On one level, anger is communicating to us, hey, there's something wrong here. Something's not okay. Something about this situation is not okay. There's some feelings of hurt here. And constructive anger, if we can become curious about the feeling, not be completely absorbed in it, not be completely immersed in it, but create some spaciousness and ask yourself, what is this anger about? In what ways am I feeling hurt? The anger can be constructive in terms of helping us stand up for ourselves or stand up for others. We experience anger when we see people being bullied or we see social injustice. It can motivate us to take action to try to help, and that's constructive anger. If we're totally absorbed in our anger, totally fused with our anger, we're more at risk, again, just for attacking others. And this is destructive anger. Another way of thinking about it is when we create some space around the anger, we can call out a behavior as being wrong without attacking the person, saying this behavior or this action is not okay. It needs to stop. It needs to be addressed. It's different than going after a person and saying, you're a bad person, and because you're a bad person, I'm going to hurt you.
And I remember from your presentation, you said we can name it. If I'm feeling anxiety, I can say anxiety, yes. Mm-hmm. Anger, yes. Mm-hmm. I've been doing it, mm-hmm. and it helps. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I'm essentially talking to myself.
First of all, you're validating your experience. Kristen Neff differentiates between tender compassion and fierce compassion. Part of tender compassion is just acknowledging our experience, validating our experience. It's bringing awareness to our experience and acting as if, to quote Kabat-Zinn, acting as if our life matters. From a neuroscience standpoint, we know that when we name emotions, some of the activity in the amygdala, the emotional center of our brain, calms down. It's not magic. It doesn't make the emotions just disappear. But if we can say to ourselves, there's some anger here, or there's some anxiety here, it helps us to hold the emotion without reacting to it. If we think about the three steps within Germer and Neff's mindful self-compassion, there's these three components. There's the mindfulness component, which is what you're describing, this idea of naming what we're experiencing. Then there's also this common humanity, remembering that we're not alone in experiencing this. Other people that would be going through the situation would be feeling anger too, that other people get frustrated or go through periods of time where they're feeling pain and they want to lash out, that I'm not alone in feeling this anger. Also the self-kindness. Self-kindness could be saying, this is really hard right now. What I'm experiencing is really difficult. A quintessential self-compassion question to ask ourselves when we are feeling some distressing emotion, what do I need right now? Or how can I care for myself? It might be I need to say to somebody, this behavior is not okay. What you're saying is hurtful. I'm experiencing hurt, and I'm not going to allow you to hurt me this way. It may be that what I need right now is I need to go take a walk outside and get some fresh air. Or it may be that what I need is to call a close friend and say, can you believe what this person just did? You're able to name the emotion, and then it creates a little bit of space. Tara Brach talks about the power of the pause. When we feel strong emotions, sometimes we feel the emotion and then there's a stimulus and response. We feel anger and then we act. One of the ways we pause is by naming what we're feeling. There's some anger here. What else is here? Maybe there's feelings of hurt. Maybe there's feelings of judgment or being judged. Maybe there's feelings of loss of control. It's very rare that we only feel one thing. We can start to name these different emotions. When we pause and do that, we create space. It's not stimulus response. Suddenly, it's stimulus, mindfulness, and now we have some freedom to choose how we want to respond.
I think that's really important, recognizing that a lot of the time there's a stimulus and then there's a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this ability, we can work on this ability to create space so we can respond as opposed to react. Were you somebody that was really hard on yourself? How has mindful self-compassion impacted your life personally?
It's good that we're talking about anger. I'm the oldest of six kids. I come from a big family. We're all very unique personalities. I came into the world with low frustration tolerance and quick to anger. As a young child, if I got frustrated, I would literally take my head and bang my head on the sidewalk. There was that level of tantruming. For me, I grew up in a family with one parent who was a valedictorian. The other parent was high achieving in physics and math. I grew up in a family like probably a lot of professionals where the expectations were just extremely high. Only A's were acceptable. We have this culture where everybody feels the pressure to be above average, which is completely unrealistic. How can everybody be above average? But we walk around feeling like we should be above average in everything we do. Yes, to answer your question, it was both instilled in me, both on a family level, also on a cultural level, that being average is not okay. Being below average is certainly not okay. I like the work of the psychologist Paul Gilbert. Paul Gilbert frames self-compassion from an evolutionary psychology perspective, that human beings come into the world with a threat defense system, which is widely talked about. It's that fight, flight, freeze response. If we see a threat in our environment, we tend to want to fight it, whether it's physically or verbally, or run from it. But a lot of our threats are perceived threats to self. So fighting it, it often takes the form of self-criticism. It's one part of ourself attacking another part of ourself. The threat of rejection or embarrassment is something we all experience, that we don't want to embarrass ourselves. We don't want to be rejected or be in the out group. Self-criticism can show up as the internal voice that says, why did you say that? That was so dumb. Don't say anything like that again. What's happening there is there's a threat to self. One of the core human fears is fear of being kicked out of the tribe. In that moment, that threat response is happening. But there's also the mammalian caregiving system, which is where compassion is based. This innate part of ourselves to want to care for others. We see it most prominently in the relationship between parents and their children, in our relationships with friends. These two different responses are quite different. The fight, flight, freeze activates all our stress response. Adrenaline, cortisol, blood pressure rises, heart rate rises. If we stay in it for any significant amount of time, it shuts down our digestive system. We're really tense and we're on edge, ready to fight or ready to run. The freeze response is where we get stuck in our thoughts when we ruminate over the same thoughts over and over again. Whereas when you look at when people respond, if we say, all right, there's anger here. I can feel a lot of anger here. I am so angry right now. What is going on? What is this anger about? This is really hard right now. I'm doing all I can to get through it. When we respond in that compassionate way, what we're starting to do is activate the parasympathetic nervous system. We're starting to release oxytocin and endorphins. We're starting to lower our blood pressure and lowering our heart rate. We're creating feelings of connection and safety. We have both the threat defense system and the mammalian caregiving system, and we need both. If we don't have the mammalian caregiving system, think how hard it is to raise young newborn babies, young children, right? Most people would say, this is not for me. I'm not getting any sleep. All you do is cry all the time. But it's hardwired into us to want to care for them, to keep them safe, to protect them. The more we practice different kinds of self-compassion, the more that we are in that mammalian caregiving system, and that benefits our relationships and it benefits our emotional and physical health. And self-compassion is the antidote to self-criticism. Connecting to a mammalian caregiving system is a natural way to care for ourselves and care for others when terrible things happen or challenging situations arise.
Do you think that someone could start seeing results fast when they're starting a daily mindful self-compassion practice? Or do you see this as something more as a lifelong practice?
It's certainly a lifelong practice. I wish I could say, do this for 6 months and then it's just going to stick. What we do see from a neuroscience perspective, when people start a guided meditation, compassion practice, or they start within the mindful self-compassion curriculum, there's development of new neural pathways, more activity in the compassionate part of our brain. There's a robust body of research literature that shows, yes, we can learn to become more self-compassionate. And when we do, we experience less anxiety, less depression, less stress, and less feelings of shame. We also feel more connection with other living beings and other human beings. We feel more feelings of safety, more feelings of joy. When we practice it, it's like developing a muscle, like it's our brain muscle. We get better at it. There's a negativity bias in human beings' thinking in general. We pay much more attention to the things that bother us or we don't like. I've read where there's estimates as much as 85% of our thoughts tend to be critical about things we don't like, whether it's I don't like the weather, I don't like how my body's looking this morning, I don't like how my hair is, I don't like the noise that person next to me is making. There's lots of focus on the negative. And so that tendency to self-criticism and to criticism of others is really strong. By doing an intentional self-compassion practice, we start to push back against that. And again, we start to spend more time in the mammalian caregiving system as opposed to living out of the threat defense system.
Lifelong practice definitely is going to take time. Mm-hmm. However, it's expanding our neurological well-being, yeah, which manifests into better emotional well-being. Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it's just 4 or 8 weeks of training is a lot of what the research has looked at in compassion practice, and gains within 4 and 8 weeks, less stress, less anxiety. I think about some of the work they've done with healthcare workers, less burnout, less reported secondary traumatic stress, more job satisfaction. People find their lives to be more meaningful, more purposeful. That's just within research or randomized control trials. When you look at some of the meta-analysis out there, you see these gains can happen pretty quickly. One of the things I have not mentioned is feelings of self-worth. Kristen Neff talks about the difference between self-compassion and self-esteem, and makes the point that self-esteem is largely based on comparisons. When we compare ourselves to others or to some standard we set for ourselves and we're doing well, we generally feel good about ourselves. But when we make those comparisons and we feel like we're coming up short and regarding our own goals or standards, we feel bad about ourselves. When we compare ourselves to others and it comes back unfavorably, we feel bad about ourselves. Self-esteem is very contextual and it's not very dependable. Self-compassion is much more dependable, and it starts from a perspective that our lives matter, that we have intrinsic goodness, and more self-compassionate we become, the greater our feelings of self-worth.
That's a very important distinction, mm-hmm, self-esteem, mm-hmm, versus self-compassion. Self-esteem stemming from comparison. How about comparing ourselves with ourselves? Say one day you lifted 100 pounds, but the next day you did 80, mm-hmm, comparing to a past version of yourself.
Mm-hmm. I think it speaks to why it's hard to be human and why it's hard to be a living being. We all age, right? We all suffer disappointments. The only constant in life is change. We all experience illness. Sometimes we're more disciplined in our practice and sometimes we're less disciplined. We all make mistakes. We all have people that we love that get sick or people that we love that die. We all have friends that come and go or that we lose touch with. We all have relationships that end. It's really easy to romanticize the past and to want to cling. When things are going well, we want to hold on to it. We don't want it to go away. We try to cling, but nothing stays the same. So compassion, it's a little bit different. I like this distinction that the Dalai Lama makes between loving kindness and compassion. Loving kindness is the wish for living beings to be happy, whereas compassion is the wish for human beings or living beings to be free of suffering. Those are important practices. And when things are going well, we want to savor those experiences. We fully enjoy them. Listening to an audiobook titled How We Live is How We Die. It's reflections on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And this awareness that the birth and death is perpetually happening. All good experiences come to an end. I may have had a really enjoyable meal this morning, but now that's just a memory. Now I'm here with you having an enjoyable conversation, and an hour from now, that will be a memory.
How do we get okay with that?
It's a practice. It's really hard because we don't want good things to end, and we generally don't like change, and we want to feel like we can control things. The self-compassion practice is recognizing that it's really sad that as much as we might have a wonderful experience, it comes to an end. Every year, there's some kind of ranking system for the countries with the most happiness, and Finland, several years in a row, has been ranked as the happiest country. I remember reading a New York Times article where they did a feature on Finland and they profiled some of the people in Finland. They talked about the saying that everything good ends in tears or something like that. It's a saying in Finland, everything good ends in tears. This is built in awareness that with all the beauty and wonderful in the world, there is also loss. It's impermanent. Impermanence is something that we can never stop, and impermanence in its ultimate form, of course, comes in the form of death.
There's this underlying belief or awareness that change is constant, mm-hmm. and even good things will end in tears. Mm-hmm. Maybe that even makes life as it is now sweeter. And when it does change or it does end, we've prepped ourselves in a way, mm-hmm. and we're able to be more resilient as we experience that change.
You are absolutely right. All these things are practice opportunities. I think with my own parents that are aging, one of the things I remind myself is, let me build a relationship with who they are now, not who they were 20 years ago. You know, let me love them or spend quality time with them based on what they're able to do now. I think about the wife of Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis is experiencing dementia. There's really hard parts of dementia because there's a lot of loss around day-to-day functioning. There's still really sweet moments. There's still moments of real connection and love. But if we're focused on this relationship is not what it was 10 years ago, then we're not able to enjoy what the relationship can be right now.
Someone that's listening and they want to start implementing some of these ideas in their lives, let's say they catch themselves making a comparison like, oh, today's a nice day, but it wasn't as nice as it was yesterday, mm-hmm. for example. How can we correct that? Is that something we say in our heads, I just compared today to yesterday? What kind of mental dialogue could we have with ourselves?
So I think going back to the feeling, oh, there's feelings of sadness right now. There's feelings of sadness that the beautiful day we had yesterday has ended, and that today that there's cloudiness here. it's hard to be out in the world when it's cloudy. Let me remind myself that there will be more sunny days. Let me see if I can notice the different shades of gray. Let me see if I can be interested in these clouds. It's a cool, dreary day. Let me see if I can appreciate the way the air smells. Is there some beauty I can find in this moment? We can notice that we might start with, oh gosh, I hate that it's cloudy today. Yesterday was so much better. But then trying to connect to the feeling, what am I feeling right now? I'm feeling sad, or I'm feeling loss, or I'm feeling longing. You know, I think in the heart of winter, there's often a longing for warmth and some sun. Okay, there's longing here. That's what I'm feeling, is some deep longing. It's hard to feel this right now. What do I need? So this idea of these kind of self-compassion breaks, you don't have to say bad me for comparing today with yesterday. You can just note. You notice that you're comparing today to yesterday, and then connect to the feeling. And the other thing we haven't spoken about is a lot of the practice that Tara Brach emphasizes is this idea of locating emotion in your body. So yes, name the emotion. There's sadness here. Where do I feel the sadness in my body? Can I actually locate it? It helps you to stay with the feeling and not dissociate from the feeling, not avoid the feeling, not deny it or try to escape from it, but just connect with it and say, where do I feel it in my body? Maybe even putting your hands to where you feel the sadness. A lot of times it might be in our chest or in our heart. And then this idea of, let me take a deep breath and breathe into the sadness. Let me be with the sadness. And that practice allows you to validate and honor, acknowledge your experience. It's also a soothing practice.
I really appreciate you saying that about where in the body we feel these things. For me, anxiety and anger, it's all in the chest. When I feel myself getting angry, I can actually feel my body buzzing. How can people sign up for mental health therapy? Also, if they wanted to learn more about mindful self-compassion, where would you direct them as far as resources go?
For counseling sessions, you can go to the University of Kentucky's Work Life and Well-Being page. There's 7 therapists. 4 of us are full-time therapists. Each of us have profiles that talks about our approach to counseling and our training and background. You just schedule an appointment online through the website. In addition, we sometimes have individual colleges or departments that will send us a request and say, hey, can you do a self-compassion training and workshop for our group? And we'd love to do those.
Eric, if somebody tuned in only for this last bit, what would you want them to know?
I would want them to know that you're not alone, that when you feel pain and suffering, that is intrinsic to being human in life. And that how we respond to our suffering really matters. It really makes a difference in terms of our quality of life. Self-compassion is a way of relating to ourselves with warmth and kindness. It's being a companion. It's bearing witness to our life journey. We experience the world as both a subject and an object. We're a subject with agency that can take action. But we are also an object where things happen to us all the time outside of our control. Compassion and self-compassion are innate resources we have to care for ourselves during difficult times.
I learned something new, experiencing life as both subject and object. Mm-hmm. Eric, thank you so much for being on Becoming Wildly Resilient today, and I appreciate your time.
I really appreciate you having me here, and I love all the work that you all do with this podcast.
Thank you for listening to Becoming Wildly Resilient. This podcast is brought to you by University of Kentucky Human Resources Health and Wellness. We offer a wide range of online and in-person services to support the well-being of UK employees, retirees, and their spouses. You can find experts in mental health, personal resilience, nutrition, and physical activity. We're ready to meet you where you are and address your unique needs. To learn more about the work, life, and well-being services offered by UK Human Resources, visit hr.uky.edu/wellbeing. You can also connect with us on social media and YouTube by searching at UKY Wellness or by email at healthandwellness@uky.edu.